The dilemma is that this does not resemble.
Yes.
I'm trying to find my museum. It didn't look like this. Where is there education in the basement somewhere?
Education. We're going through an expansion process, so education has been.
That won't mean anything to me at all then.
Yeah, not accessible.
Okay, well, the other reason this museum does not resemble my experience was that mine was empty.
Of people.
Yeah, no, there was never anybody there.
Take it to galleries that are empty.
Sure. Okay, all right, let's do some of that.
No, but should we still start with American?
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
All right,
please,
so
yes. So I can tell the group that we've found some kind of dreadful conventional paintings that were hugely influential to me when I was 12 or 13 years old, particularly anything with snow in it, because that's my name. And as I told some of you, I painted like this because I didn't know you needed turpentine. So I used to, my earliest works, I just squeezed when I found somebody's old set of oil paints. I squeezed them onto a board, and I had a knife, and I did a snow scene. It was my first. It looked like my early work, but better. It's really quite better, but I understand the technique. It's pitiful. Okay. This is much more sophisticated, but also very heavy with a palette knife. So we're going to approach some really subtle, beautiful brushwork. Yeah. But I remark on the little details here. That's not kind of a bold optical intercession to find that red, and here it is connected to a little hat. Where else do we see it? A little spark in there, a little spark there. Country life, it's also Redfield. It's very nice. It's beautiful, right? It's so seductive. The softening of the tonalities out into the horizon. It's a very vibrant autumnal work. And obviously it was taken very seriously because in the olden days, the bigger the frame, the more expensive the painting had been, right? Yeah. So are we going to come to the 40s. The 40s are very interesting to me. Will we approach them?
The earliest we have in terms of American art in there is the roots of abstract expressionism. So it
right.
kind of jumps a bit.
But this is what I would have been looking at before I knew about abstract expressionism, particularly this kind of work that was influenced by Cézanne, but I didn't know that. So that there's a whole period of Americana work, and this is the 30s. Where there's a structuralist format that's analyzing proportion and shape pretty much in terms of some of Cézanne's early principles. It's a very special genre. It disappears. It's not with us for too long, but it was important for me. Oh, why? Oh, and then the dark
ones. Do you remember that at the time there was more of a representation of this period in the museum?
Oh, yeah, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. I came back here, when was I here? 2 years ago. I couldn't find anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, first of all, the museums weren't all white. They didn't look like hospitals. Mm-hmm. The walls were gray or just old. Mm-hmm. Everything hadn't been brightened or tarted mm-hmm. up. And this is a wonderful period with Sloan, mm-hmm. kind of Americana, looking at spaces and events and the kinds of active figuration. And then the dark Sloans are very compelling and beautiful. That it's an unusual aspect of oil painting to come upon, where suddenly all the tonalities are reduced, they're dark, they're shadowy. Oh, Robert Henri, very important, influential painter of the time. Yeah, classic, academic, but very vibrant and lively. It's beautiful. It's really beautiful. Just come up close and see how all the optical effects are so richly in the material and the brushwork. It's a whole other visual universe when you go up close. Yeah, put your nose up. Oh my God, Dr. Mercer, look what we found, Doylestown. Oh dear. Something very unusual happened to me when I was 14 years old in this museum that was built by a madman named Dr. Mercer. And it was a museum of glazed earthenware and tiles. He was also an alchemist who researched all kinds of poisons. So he had a museum in his house, and he had cast most all of his furniture in his bathtub and the toilet out of ceramics. But in the basement, there was a secret seductive room full of armor and benches, and that's where my boyfriend knew that we should go. There were no guards down. There were no guards anywhere. But Dr. Mercer had all these poisons. He had the most extensive library of how to poison everything and how poisons had been evolved and developed. So he was always considered a suspect when someone in the Lancaster area died mysteriously. So this is one of his very benign, this is very benign, and most of his tiles had a ceramic innocence, I would say. But there was this dark side to his temperament. And it was a wonderful place to be seduced. And it's amazing. I've always had a strong feeling for armor since then. Let's see. This is very disgusting. This is a prototypical, idealized female. She's holding a bird. She's always holding something. She's usually on one toe, almost naked. She's always holding a bunch of attributes that no living female could ever balance on one knee. Sometimes it's a baby and a bird.
She's an allegory of the Schuylkill River.
Oh, she's the Schuylkill River as a symbol. Mm-hmm. That's why she's green. Well, I'm pausing here because it's also a disturbing idealization of a woman who has 3 extra inches in her neck. And we're all to try to attain that deformation. It's remained culturally idealized. The sketches are wonderful here. Look at these. Oh. Well, I love these sketches because they're so immediate in their articulation, and they have so much space around them. So it's a kind of initiatory exploration of what might be developed in a more complex, prolonged work. They're beautiful. Aren't they wonderful?
They are, yeah. They have that immediacy of, as you said, seeing something happen.
Yeah. So they really anticipate an aspect of modernism and abstraction. They're quick, they're suggestive, they don't have any of that overdetermined academic expectation that he could fulfill so beautifully, so perfectly. Okay, let's see if I can find the really bad painting that I love. Oh, where are the painters from the 30s and 40s? Do we have any of them?
Not in this wing. We have to go to the other side. This is
other side.
Now we're going back to this, like the Hudson River School, and then it goes.
No, we don't have too much time. Let's go
back
to where.
Let's go to the modern and contemporary.
Okay, thank you.
Amanda will lead the way, so just follow her.
Everything seemed quite rare because there weren't many people looking everywhere. Yeah.
It felt like you had the space to yourself.
Yes, and it's like you're making incredible discoveries of everything. It was shadowy. It was mysterious. Everything wasn't polished and feeling. Oh, but you'll see in the modernist wing, things are very bright and fresh looking. And the way images of the actual works are hung and presented, it's stylized. The older system was, as I say, darker, and
you don't remember there being many guards at the time.
I don't remember so many people, especially. There may have been some guards, but no one paid any attention to me whatsoever. I felt that I had the complete freedom to move around. Well, the point is, the collection has not only grown, but it's been categorized so that the turn of the century and American painting in the 30s and 40s and 50s is nowhere to be seen here. When I was here 2 years ago, I tried to find it. And one of the major influences for me was discovering the work of Arthur Carles. Mm-hmm. It's just exquisite. He's a Philadelphia painter who goes to Europe and really brings back the first experience of the Impressionists and changes it and makes it something quite vividly his own. But he's nowhere to be seen. Is there a quiet place around here? We could just sit down and talk for a minute, because it's very echoey, though, and there's so many people here. Can come back and look at all these major historic works that are, you know, they're sublime, they're incredible. We can talk a little bit about the Havemeyer history.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the Cadwalladers. We follow you. Okay, great. Okay.
And we'll turn on some lights here.
This is nice without lights. It's fine.
Oh.
Yeah. This is a very hostile table. It must be meant for people that need to stay apart. Yes, it's, imagine living here and having breakfast with your sweetheart every morning. They're down there, yeah. And so I can't show you what I wanted to show you. And I don't know, I've told this story a bit this week about what I discovered here. I saved babysitting money and I came from Lancaster. What I told everybody was that you could take the train and come to the steps of the museum, and you would always find a bunch of kids there who knew things I didn't know. Like, they took me to the library, I don't know which one, a big one, where I stole my first poetry book by Edouard Roditi. And that's significant, because I stole that book. I didn't have any money. I barely could get the ticket for the train. I didn't know anything about Roditi, but 20 years later, when I graduated from college, I was in New York City, and I was looking at some flea markets on Hudson Street, because I needed everything, and there's a big blue, it was a metal army trunk, and on it it said, Edouard Roditi, and all his numbers, and when I opened it up, it was full of his underwear. And I thought, I have to have this. So I dragged this huge metal trunk everywhere I went through my life. I think it cost about $4 at the time. And I've always kept all my diaries and secret papers in it, and it was, I did paint it bluebird blue at some point. And now it's going with all my diaries to an archive at Stanford University. And I said to the librarians there, should I take the books out of the trunk? And they said, no, it says Roditi. So I never got to, I think maybe I met him once, but I couldn't say anything about how I came to his work. I don't know if I still have that poetry book, but that was important to me. Anyway, all these kids would be gathered on the steps there. I don't know if they were smoking dope, or, but there's always information passed around that was really significant, like how to hitchhike, where to stay at somebody's house when you wanted to run away, who had cigarettes or dope, or who was wanted to sell their guitar for $10. It was always enriching. And one of the things I discovered was that I could go into this huge museum and just wander around, and nobody was there. There weren't all these people. It wasn't a destination. It was not a cultural destination. It was a rare kind of magical, special. It was a little bit like Dr. What's-His-Name's museum. It wasn't that different in essence. So I could wander around. I saw these amazing paintings, and the paintings I wanted to show you in particular today were by...
Carles.
Which?
Carles?
Yeah. Arthur B. Carles. I was just overwhelmed with them, and I wanted to find out how you could see like that and make work like that. So I would have loved to have seen some of them today, but they were featured here because he was from Philadelphia. So I was looking at them, and then I wandered around, and as most of you know, then I smelled this incredible aroma from the basement, and I wandered down the steps, and I went down the hallway, and I kept smelling it more. I thought, it's just intoxicating. And I went in this doorway, and there were all these grown-ups that with easels and oil paints and a table full of fruit and the essential wine bottles. That's what people learn to see with. So I hovered around in the doorway, and the teacher came over and said, are you taking a class here? I said, no, I didn't know they had classes. And he said, well, you want to come in? You look like you'd like to come in. I said, yeah, I want to come in. I was like a puppy. So he said, well, would you like to draw while they're painting? I said, yeah. So he set up an easel, and he gave me some chalk and crayons and paper, and I started studying the fruit and the vase and the wine bottle, because I really wanted to know, is this how you could be an artist? Because I was always obsessively drawing and thinking that I was kind of an artist, but I didn't know how you did it. So this was a big clue. I was in the right place. And then I came back a month or so later. I went down the stairs. I smelled the wonderful smell. And there they were, the same configuration. All the grown-ups are painting. They all have their easel. And I come in, and the teacher was named Blackie. And he said, oh, it's nice you're back. I'll give you an easel, and you can paint or draw with us. And then the story that central to his experience was, after a couple hours, he took somebody's lunch bag, brown bag, and he tore it all up. And then he said, everybody come around. We came around in a circle, and he threw the torn-up bag on the floor in the middle of all of us. The grown-ups looked quite nonplussed. And he said, well, why did I do this? What is this doing? And nobody said anything, and I said, is it the rhythms between all the pieces? And he was so happy. And then he said, yes, and that's Gestalt. That's the Gestalt that we're looking at. So that was one of my big German words to hang on to. And I've taught it myself ever since. So that was initiation here. Yeah. Any questions? What else? I mean, you've all had something like that, I'm sure.